All right, so this was, I guess, supposed to be a Dharma Q&A session, but I only got two questions submitted. come to think of it, and I usually count on when I have a Dharma Q&A that I get way too many questions to answer, so then I have material for like what I should do future classes and talks and podcast episodes on. So I'm going to have Lisa put the little submit a question to Domeo in the newsletter again. So please, like, you know, be thinking about something you would like me to talk about at some point, and or you would like to hear from the rest of the Sangha about, and submit a question. So then, you know, I don't know when, but I'll get around to it. But the two questions that people submitted were very good. And I figured one of the first one I can do this whole talk on, and Zen and work. And then the second question, which I will also get around to, is very good. Somebody said, could you speak to the experience of being essentially like the only Buddhist in your family, or, you know, at work, or, you know, being surrounded by people who aren't Buddhist and you're Buddhist, and, you know, what kind of issues does that raise, and et cetera. So that'll be an interesting topic to just explore. But today, I will title this talk what the questioner put it, Zen and work, why no one wants to work anymore. So she asked, how can one's practice enhance and support the layperson as they pursue their vocation? A high percentage of people experience work stress and burnout, particularly when their vocation is in service to hard economic choices, not particularly life-affirming. So it is not difficult for me to answer this question based on Zen teachings. You know, I got some teachings I can pull out, and I didn't have the time, but I could have, there's, you know, a list of good books. There's actual, like, I think Zen and Work is an actual book. The One Who Is Not Busy by Darlene Cohen is also good. So this has been explored quite a lot, because work is actually considered a central part of Zen practice. So it's easy for me to answer this question in a sense, and it's, I answer it based on my own experience of practice, but I can't really, I'm limited in the extent that I can address it based on my own experience of having to work in the service of hard economic choices, or any work that's not particularly life-affirming. I have always been immensely privileged, not rich, but, you know, that term is relative, but privileged enough that I have rarely had to engage in a livelihood that wasn't something I wanted to do or I thought was meaningful. So many of my life choices, including not having children, have been about being able to spend my time and labor on something I feel called to do, not having to worry too much about how much money I make at it. You know, case in point, the last 20 years as a Zen priest. And in addition, in talking about this question, we should recognize and acknowledge that, rather sadly, Zen in the West tends to attract middle class to upper middle class, or even fairly wealthy people. And many have speculated on why this is. I mean, I'm guessing that it probably has to do with the fact that the idea of exploring, or having the freedom and time to explore a wacky Eastern religion in your spare time, is something that just kind of is more culturally accessible or acceptable in, you know, middle to upper class cultures, as opposed to working class cultures. So I kind of, you know, I'm trying to imagine, you know, the rare working class person, and by that I mean someone who works long hours at a job that is either low status, low paying, unfulfilling, or some combination, just to make ends meet. When they stumble into a Zen center, it must feel almost as lonely and alienating as it would be to walk in as an African-American, a recent immigrant from Mexico, for example. Just, you're not with your peeps. You're in a surrounded by people with a very different experience of life. I mean, you'd be surrounded by well-meaning, extra nice, middle-class people who drive nice, relatively new cars into the parking lot and talk cheerfully about their overseas trips and generally chat about things like the pets or the weather because, you know, their lives are relatively pleasant. And if you were, say, working 60 hours a week at a soul-sucking job and constantly stressed about whether you could even keep a roof over your head, I can imagine you might wish you were surrounded by people who shared your life experience more. And I've actually, it's very rare that, I mean, of course, we don't know. We don't actually know people's working and financial backgrounds a lot of times, except maybe over time. So people may be present today who qualify at what I'm describing. But I suspect that many folks just kind of drift away. But the thing is, Zen or Buddhist practice is the same no matter what your economic class, no matter what your life circumstances, the practice is the same. Your specific needs for Sangha might be different, right? Depending on who you are and what your circumstances are, but the practice is the same. And a great example of this is how very successful Buddhist groups are in prisons. So here you have a population, which is a much higher proportion, unfortunately, of people of color than, you know, you'd ever see in a Zen center. People with very rough and difficult backgrounds, and, you know, introduce the practice of Zen, of meditation, of precepts, of Sangha. And it's deeply, deeply meaningful and healing and everything. So it's like the circumstances may be different, but the practice is essentially the same. So we should keep in mind sensitivity to people's different circumstances as we function as a Sangha, as we share, trying to minimize the assumptions we make about, you know, what other people's circumstances are. But also, while avoiding, you know, censoring ourselves too much, I mean, we can only be who we are. So with that preamble, I will talk about Zen and work freely, even though my experience of particularly meaningless or stressful work was limited mostly to my college years. But even if you have not or are not having to work long hours at a job that's low status, low paying, unfulfilling, we all have work in our lives. You know, we all have activities we're obligated to do, which are not particularly enjoyable or fulfilling or rewarding in any conventional sense. But the essence of the Zen teaching on this is our experience of work is entirely dependent on our attitude. So this, I like to tell a story when it comes to this point. I call it my tale of two waitresses. Because I think it just indelibly printed on my mind in terms of practice. So it was quite early on in my practice, and I was traveling around doing pygmy-owl surveys, and I was staying in a little motel. So I must have stayed there two nights for some reason, because I had two opportunities to go to breakfast in the little restaurant that was attached to the hotel. And I can't remember which one came first. Let's just describe. Well, let's say one day I go in and there's, you know, a woman who, the waitress, she, you know, welcomes me in, you know, seats me to the table. There's a attitude of just joy and friendliness and care. Like, she really wanted everyone to feel like they were, you know, welcome, and that this was a, you know, a small town, cozy kind of place. And I don't even remember how the food was, right? But just, it's like everybody in the place ended up just happier, just kind of feeling more connected, and you know, went off to their days just nourished, you know, in ways that had nothing to do with the food. And then, you know, looking forward to that opportunity, the second day I go in, and there's a different waitress. And, you know, I mean, who knows what was going on in this woman's life, right? You know, her life could have been falling apart. Who knows why? But, you know, clearly this was not where she wanted to be. This job was just a pain in the ass. Everybody who came in was a pain in the ass. And you know from your own experience that when you have this attitude, stuff starts to go wrong, and you forget stuff and you drop stuff and it just makes it worse. And it was just like, just the polar opposite. I mean, everybody in the restaurant was kind of like, you know, like on edge from just like, how much worse is this going to get? And she's, you know, you feel kind of some sympathy, but it was just so striking how, you know, here's the same job, same circumstance, and how different that attitude made it. So that always sticks in my mind, is like, yeah, you know, it really does depend on our attitude, not on the job. So in terms of the teachings, I did do, there's two episodes on the Zen Studies podcast website on the Dogen's Tenzo Kyokun, which is his instructions to the monastery cook. And they're episodes 25 and 26. If you just go to the Zen Studies podcast website and type in work, they'll pop up. And they also, I also added to them a link to the text of the Tenzo Kyokun, if you want to read it, or just you can look it up online too. So this is in Zen, Soto Zen in particular, looked at as, I mean, Dogen gives very, very specific instructions to the monastery cook about not just their attitude, but the practical aspects of their job. And we see it as, this can be applied to whatever work we do. We can approach whatever work we do with the same attitude. And I like to, so ironically in Zen, once you're familiar with it and you've been to some retreats and stuff like that, the Tenzo is really, really respected. For one thing, when you're at a session, you have no other source of pleasure besides whatever food shows up. So everybody is kind of, I've been to sessions, I'm a little pickier about the food, but I've been like, not thought the food was remarkable at all, but afterwards people are like, the food was so delicious. It pretty much, it doesn't actually have to be that amazing, and people will really enjoy it. So it's actually kind of a esteemed job, but I don't think when Dogen wrote the Tenzo Kyokun, I don't think that was the case. I suspect that just like many places, the cook was just, you know, that was just a menial task. You know, the people who taught or the people who were administrators or the people who sat zazen, like, were, you know, of higher status than the cook. But he tried to really turn that on its head, right? And talk about how being the cook could be this incredible opportunity to practice. Because ideally there is no separation between our practice and our life. This is an ideal, especially when we start practice. It's pretty inevitable that practice feels special, right? It's this thing you do, it's this thing you're learning and exploring, and it's got texts and practices and da-da-da-da, and then you hoping that it kind of filters in and informs your life. But the idea is over time that there's no separation, that we are practicing every moment, that our activities of work and Dogen wrote instructions for his monks about how they should brush their teeth, how they should wipe their butt after going to the bathroom, how they should wash their face, all kinds of incredibly mundane tasks that they were supposed to do with this kind of care and mindfulness. So that's the idea, is no matter what we are doing, when we're interacting with our family, when we're sitting and watching Netflix with a glass of wine in our hand, when we're driving in bad traffic, when we're caring for our own health, when we're facing death, it's all supposed to be an opportunity to practice. Nothing is excluded whatsoever. So we try to bring that light of awareness to everything we do. We try at each moment to live deliberately. So no matter what is going on, asking ourselves, what choices can I make here that will decrease suffering and increase wisdom and compassion? What actions of body, speech, or mind will be beneficial? What can I learn? So, and this is, again, it's an ideal, like most of us are not actually walking around at every moment, but at least we can recall that, right? When we recognize we're in a challenging situation whenever we remember. So just briefly, because I want to focus today on the challenges to making work our practice. Because I could obviously do several Dharma talks on the practice, work practice, as described by Dogen. But I'm just going to briefly summarize it. And if you want to know more, you can look at those podcast episodes that are specifically about the Tenzo Kyokan and how it applies to work. So I identified five principles. One, taking joy in serving others. Dogen writes, the true bond established between ourselves and the Buddha is born of the smallest offering made with sincerity, rather than of some grandiose donation made without it. This is our practice as human beings. And then the second is treating each thing as the body of the Buddha. So Dogen quotes a Chinese Chan master, use the property and possessions of the community as carefully as if they were your own eyes. So there's several parts in the places in the Tenzo Kyokan which he talks about teaching, treating the ingredients or the implements, the utensils, as if they were parts of your own body, they were your own eyes. And if you think about that difference in attitude, right? If you were handling your own eyeball, you would be really, really mindful and careful. As opposed to, how often do we just handle things? They're just a means to an end, who cares? And the attitude, having that attitude that each thing is the body of the Buddha is not just, it's a good practice to try to imagine that and cultivate respect for things, but it also points us to the reality of things. When we awaken to things as they are, to the boundarylessness of self, we recognize each of these things really is that precious. Life is short, it's passing quickly. Every one of these things is actually a blessing. So the third is refusing to be pushed around by judgments and preferences. Dogen says, your attitude towards things should not be contingent on their quality. A person who is influenced by the quality of a thing, or who changes his speech and manner according to the appearance or position of the people he meets, is not a person working in the way. That one's easy, right? The fourth is doing the best job you possibly can. So he talks about a Tenzo that he met in China, who was 68 years old and drying mushrooms in the hot sun. He says the sun's rays beat down so harshly that the tiles along the walk burned one's feet. And he says he was concerned about the Tenzo, whose back was bent and whose eyebrows were crane white. So he asked why he never didn't have just assistance doing this. And the old monk replied, other people are not me. Dogen says, you are right. I can see that your work is the activity of the Buddha Dharma. But why are you working so hard in this scorching sun? The Tenzo answered, if I do not do it now, when else can I do it? So there's a lot to unpack there, but I'll move on. And then the fifth is becoming one with your activity. Or as we might say in modern terms, getting in the zone, you know? Dogen says, if we would only step back and reflect carefully on the way our minds are usually racing about and how often our emotions are unmanageable, he says our lives would naturally become one with our work. So these are very, very demanding ideals. So I thought we could use as a test case a job I had during a summer between years of college. So I worked 4 10-hour days a week at a shampoo factory. You know, it can be hard, kind of hard to find temporary jobs as a college student. And I had like an uncle or something who was a manager at this factory. So, you know, I was supposed to be grateful. And the one thing that I took away from it was at least this factory was clean. So I don't think it was where they made the shampoo. Maybe they made the shampoo somewhere else, but I worked in the part where you bottled and packaged the shampoo and hairspray. And so I would, you know, get up at, I don't know, like 3:30 in the morning, and I don't know, we were probably on the job by 5, which means I was really tired. And one job was watching the hairspray bottles on the conveyor belt as they came through this window where a machine had stuck the little sprayer with the, you know, a little straw, you know, into the bottle, and then the next step was to like screw it on, I think. But they needed somebody to sit there because occasionally it didn't work right. And if a bottle that didn't have the cap on went over to the bottle, the screwer, it could tip over and really damage the machine. So at 5 a.m., I had to, you know, sit there and watch hairspray bottles go by. And I had a really hard time. And, you know, this is a great improvement over, you know, what our ancestors did, because they had we were rotated every 15 minutes, I think. You know, once upon a time, right? That would have been my job all day. But at least, you know, so we were rotated, and they would tell us when these machines were shut down, it cost them like $1,000 a minute. Like, it was extremely expensive for them to shut these machines down when there was an error, or even just for us to switch, right? So, but they did switch us, which was great. And there were other jobs, like taking a bin of empty bottles and then putting them onto the conveyor belt. And you had to make sure not to jostle the bottles, because then the machine that was putting shampoo in the bottles would hit the edge of the bottle, and then the shampoo would go all over the floor, and then we'd have to stop and everybody'd have to clean it up, which was kind of, that was kind of fun. But, you know, and then there was the end of the line where you had like six shampoo bottles packaged together, and then you had to like lift them up and plunk them into a box really fast. So when I worked at this job, I found myself wishing there was a way I could just sell 10 hours of my life. If I could just like, here's 10 hours. I don't care if I, you know, I don't want to experience it. I don't want to remember it. Just take it. And, you know, I'd be happy to do that. But alas, it doesn't work that way. I mean, I got a little bit of amusement out of, you know, trying to master those tasks and like be really fast at boxing shampoo and stuff, but that only goes so far, right? Then you're really good at it, and that's it. Now, ironically, I know I was just there for the summer, and I was just thinking, oh yeah, I'm motivated to go back to college. But there were a lot of other people at this factory who they were in the process of hiring a handful of people for like full-time permanent positions, and many people were temporary. And like, these people really, really wanted those permanent jobs. And when it came out who got the jobs and other people didn't, you know, there was a lot of sadness and upset. And, you know, it was like so humbling to me to recognize, you know, my attitude toward this work, and then, you know, other people for whom this was a big, big deal. So if I look back and I think, if I had this job, for me, illustrates some of the challenges to fulfilling these ideals of Dogen, right? So we say taking joy in serving others. I think there's, you know, there's jobs for which that is easier and jobs for which that is more challenging. You know, the satisfaction of being a teacher, or even of like arranging beautiful produce in a produce department and, you know, doing customer service there or something, you know, it's like to try to imagine, you know, I just can't wait for people to get this shampoo, and was a stretch. Now I could do it, but the point that I'm trying to make is the admission that, you know, certain circumstances, certain jobs are easier to practice this for than others. And then in terms of treating each thing as the body of the Buddha, yes, I mean, I've never been careless with things, but I wasn't seeing the whole thing as the body of the Buddha in any way, right? This is much later in my practice, I think, would have helped me see in what way that factory was no different than anywhere else, right? And refusing to be pushed around by judgments and preferences, you know, we can have some strong preferences, which is very difficult, if not impossible, to just fight, right? I should like this. I should like this. That is quite a koan in and of itself, is how could we, because there's a certain extent in which those preferences are not going to go away. So it's more a matter of just abiding with our preferences despite the fact that we do not get to indulge them, which is quite a challenge to the self. I mean, I quit another awful job, which was being a certified nursing assistant in a facility where I worked the graveyard shift, and I was responsible for about 17 dementia patients at the same time. And once again, there are plenty of people who like this is their main line of work and they're very grateful for the jobs, but I recognize like you don't do this unless you have to, right? This is not a job just like, I just love that. That's what I want to do. It's something that's driven out of necessity because, not because taking care of people is, that's the joyous part, but you're doing it within what we all know is a broken healthcare system. One person should not be responsible for 17 dementia patients at night who get out of their beds and think it's time to go to work and they're not supposed to walk around unattended. And it totally stressed me out that I couldn't take proper care. So I don't know, if I had had to stay, I would have just had to find a way to just face that misery over and over every day. And doing the best job that you can, that's one that, you know, you can get some mileage out of. But then, you know, like I said, there can be a limit to how good you can do a particularly meaningless or menial task, or a task that in many cases is like broken down to like, you don't get the satisfaction of seeing the end result or, you know, broadening your skills or something like that. You just do this one tiny little thing. And becoming one with your activity or getting in the zone, that was a difficult one. So what other kinds of things, and when we opened it up, I'm happy to hear from other people, what kind of things make it challenging to make our work practice? And I was thinking of fatigue, stress, pressure, you know, whether that's economic pressure, we have to keep doing this job, or, you know, for some reason we have to keep doing this job. Injustice, discrimination, difficult people, abuses of power, jobs that are really physically demanding, exhausting, perhaps even gradually debilitating or dangerous. A lack of appreciation or acknowledgement from either those we work with or our bosses or or the people we're serving. Being subject to abuse by those you serve, being part of a poor organization, like poorly organized organization, being asked to break precepts, a moral objection to your own work, work that is really repetitive, work that doesn't seem to you to be achieving its aim, like the whole point of what you're doing, and it just doesn't seem like it's working. Or perhaps exposure to people in need that you can't do much to help. So I think the two most challenging areas of practice are interpersonal interactions and work. So, you know, we can make a lot of progress in our practice in terms of zazen and study and even just our spiritual attitude, and so much of the time we do pretty okay. And then like it's the interpersonal interactions, especially with people with whom there's some investment, right? They're either family or friends or coworkers or something. They're not just anonymous strangers, right? Interactions, and then of course our work, which is where many of us spend most of our time. It arouses our defensiveness, our concern for our well-being, concerns about our physical well-being and that of those we love. We get concerned about our status and our skill. It challenges our ego through power differentials, sometimes through real threats to our well-being. It arouses our desire for meaning and reward, and may conflict with our conscience. So it's helpful to me to recall that the Eightfold Path that the Buddha laid out included right action, right speech, and right livelihood. So right from the outset, he made it clear that like right action or, you know, moral behavior, right speech, which is really, you know, interactions with other people, and right livelihood. So even this, though this was primarily a teaching for monks, this was like the monks had their own version of right livelihood, which is be a good monk if you're accepting alms. if you're accepting donations, you're not a good monk, then that's not right livelihood. But it also, of course, included good lay people and, you know, had certain recommended livelihoods that are not recommended livelihoods, ones that involve killing or, you know, selling drugs or slavery and various things like that. But like, if you want to practice, it's a bad idea to be spending your time at this kind of livelihood. But of course, then, you know, that's relatively simple, but, you know, more and more, there's more and more moral ambiguity about so much of what we do in modern life that I think there's very few of us, whatever livelihood we have, has some implications which are not that great. So anyway, these are ideals, and we might think of them like so many of our practice ideals as just a direction. This is the direction we try to turn whenever we remember. So I'll just close with one of those super, super ideals as presented by Dogen. So he says, before midnight, to the cook here, before midnight, direct your attention to organizing the following day's work. After midnight, now he's going to be probably waking up at like 4 a.m. to cook, right? So this is after midnight, begin preparations for the morning meal. After the morning meal, wash the pots and cook the rice and soup for the noon meal. When soaking the rice and measuring the water, the tenzo should be present at the sink. So elsewhere he talks about how he's shaking his head because he's seen places where the tenzo just has an assistant do this. Which is like, I don't know, the tenzo is gonna supposed to do everything, I guess. So the tenzo should be present at the sink. Keep your eyes open. Do not allow even one grain of rice to be lost. Wash the rice thoroughly, put it in the pot, light the fire, and cook it. There is an old saying that says, see the pot as your own head, see the water as your lifeblood. So I always think about that when I'm washing rice and trying not to lose a single grain. That isn't easy. And there's part of me that's just like, were you ever really a Tenzo Dogen? So with that, I'll just open it to 10 minutes. Sorry, I went so long. 10 minutes.
Two quick things, not questions, but just you made me think of I've worked for 20 years in training and development for a automotive finance company. So kind of white collar. And I, for most of my work history, I was kind of the guy that ruffled feathers, you know, and I would get a talking to by my boss, like, you probably shouldn't have ordered that email that way, or, you know, like things like that. And after I started practicing, that started to shift. And I realized that a lot of it was because I was bringing so much of my ego identity into the work. Like, you know, this is who I am and this is what I do. And if you cross me, then, you know, you're the one to blame, you know, like that whole setting up the self and other thing. And the more that I was just able to relax into, doesn't matter that I'm, you know, and I've purposely not sought promotion, like going up the ladder. I purposely stayed in the same role for 16 years because this is what I do best, you know, and just relaxing into the role and not worrying about what do I stand to lose or gain. And just what am I being asked to do? It doesn't matter how minuscule or important it is, do it wholeheartedly. It's really made my satisfaction level and my relationships with others improve greatly. So I appreciate, and then I came to that teaching after that. I was like, oh, that kind of mimics my own experience. So I was glad for that. But the other thing is, you know, somebody once asked, if there's any job that you've done in the past that you could do again, Money, not an object. What would that job be? I was a janitor for the Postal Service. I cleaned an entire, like the main branch for Northern Arizona. It was a huge facility. And I had to clean it every night, sweeping and mopping. And I would go into the main area where all the post office boxes are, you know. And this is Flagstaff, 7,000 feet. It's like snow, 3 feet of snow all winter, you know, rain and all that. And I would walk into the main lobby, this huge room, and I would get excited if the floor was just a disaster, like just mud everywhere, you know, for people that attracted in. It's like, oh, good, I get to, you know, like there was this sense of satisfaction of like mopping the floor and seeing the clean floor right next to this hideously dirty floor. You know, like, there was like, there was something really appealing about that. And just like working alone and doing things at my own pace and, you know, money, no object, I would do that job all over again, 7 times a Sunday, because just that feeling of immediate, you know, satisfaction for a job well done. Like I can see the clean floor versus the dirty floor. So those were just the two thoughts that crossed my mind as you were talking. So yeah.
Thank you. Feel free, Cloud Zendo, raise your hand or just unmute yourself. No, I'm wondering how many of you are like kind of thinking back over your jobs now. I think I enjoyed working in my college food service. And it was a strange kind of, it felt so wonderful not to care. Didn't care. And yet I would show up all smiley, like it was chaos downstairs. It was just complete chaos. You know, food would show up and these hungry college students would come and I'd just be like, what do you want? And I don't know, that kind of lightheartedness about it. It's kind of pleasant.
Are you practicing then?
Shoketsu asked if I was practicing when I was doing the food service. No. No, I just literally didn't care about it. Brian.
So I've really always enjoyed all the sort of various sort of jobs, from, you know, working in a lumberyard to making pizzas So I've always enjoyed them, and I've always enjoyed the connection that I knew they afforded to people that I, by way of class, I might not have had the same relationship with. You know, getting yelled at by the guy who didn't have a college education, but knew you had just done that thing wrong and needed to start doing it right. You know, that was, I knew that was salutary. But at the same time, I sometimes felt a little guilty because there was at the substrate of my mind an awareness, I won't be doing this in 20 years, just as you were describing. And so that's, you know, we always are connected and also separate from, but there was a kind of, you know, privilege there that wasn't illicit in any sense, but was the sort of thing that you really didn't want to take for granted. Because it took that sort of note of despair that might creep into your day, however, you know, tedious the work or hard or whatever, you knew this is not my fate. know, and it was just kind of a, when you were talking, it made me remember, you know, that kind of ambivalence or that just divided awareness of, you know, this is a connector. We are connecting. This is fun. And, you know, it's great. At the same time, you know, I know that whatever the thing that's worst about this is not my lot. You know, I will move on and do other things and so forth. So anyway, it's just.
It's so fascinating, and I'm sure that lots has been written and studied about this, and there's probably books on it and whatever, but you know, they're not just the attitude toward your work, but there's, I mean, just I guess totally different expectations about what you should get out of your work. So I think it's a kind of a privileged modern kind of middle class or above expectation that we should enjoy or have, you know, our work should be meaningful or fulfilling or something like that. Where, I mean, that's just an expectation too, right? And Buddhism tells us you cause yourself suffering with your expectations. Now, for me, that would be a very hard expectation to let go of. It's very ingrained. And yet, honestly, if I do end up someday in financial situation where I just have to work at whatever, at a job where I'm, you know, taken for granted and talked down to and given a irregular schedule and all the kinds of annoying things people face, you know, that the other people at that shampoo factory were not, you know, going like this, thinking like, oh my God, I have to get out of here. Oh, you know, I need something more meaningful. They were just doing their work and then, and internally probably glad for a good wage. And then they were thinking about how enjoyable it would be once they got off of work and could relax. I mean, it's like, in some ways, like, you know, I was making my own problem through this set of expectations. So, like I said, like the practice is the same regardless of your circumstances. So I hope that I would have the wherewithal to practice no matter what the circumstances. So we only have 1 minute, but I think Ruth Ann, you unmuted. Go ahead.
Thank you. There are some careers where, like teaching, for instance, that usually the teacher is in a different age group. Even, well, of course, you could be a professor in college, but there usually comes the status with the job, but then the age differential, generational. And so for me, there was a nobility where I would say to colleagues, we might be the only consistency in their day. It's not about them liking us, but that kind of privilege to be in that little slot in somebody's life. And, you know, no matter end results, I found that good. And then when I did, as a student, jobs where low paying, I'd think, oh, I know there's something I can learn here. And if I don't, I'm going to move on anyway.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think as we go about our day and we interact with people who just do a good job at their job, right? They have a good attitude about it. They're gracious. They even seem to bring some joy to it. You know, it's so, I mean, you know, from the receiving end, you can see how beneficial and meaningful that is. Even if technically their task is not so grand or anything, but, you know, like every time I call some kind of tech support or something, or customer service, And I'm like, I'm really pissed because it's just, you know, I've been working on this and this is broken and this, and they sold me this and da da da. And like when somebody answers and there's like, they're like, that sounds very frustrating. And I know, like, I know they're just told to say that, right? But it feels so good. It's like, yeah, you know, like, so grateful that somebody understands how upsetting this has been. So like a good customer service rep on the phone could be a real bodhisattva. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna arahant.
All right, thank you all for coming.